somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation.
Episode 26, another special edition from the Oslo Freedom Forum, The Golden Shield and the Great Firewall, featuring Mega Rajagopalan and Yuan Yang. Throughout the episodes of this podcast, covering some 2,300 years and counting, a recurring feature has been attempts by rulers and authorities to control the ability of people to communicate and spread subversive ideas that challenge the political or religious status quo. From the medieval to the Roman Inquisition, to the licensing laws of England and France. The appearance of new communication technologies or forums have always been a particular source of panic and fear for rulers. But despite their best efforts, it has more often than not proved impossible to completely halt the flow of dissent and new ideas. The Index of Prohibited Books was unable to thwart the ideas of the Reformation, the Scientific Revolution, and the Enlightenment from spreading in Europe. In the words of one 16th century Catholic censor, "What we need is a halt to printing so that the church can catch up with this deluge of publications." One wonders what that censor would have said confronted with the internet and social media. But ironically, the digital age has not only given a voice to the voiceless and allowed information to instantaneously cross borders. It has also seen the creation of the most ambitious and sophisticated attempt to control the flow and content of information in the history of mankind. I'm of course talking about China and its Golden Shield project and Great Firewall that may be succeeding where the Roman Inquisition failed. And at stake is not only the freedom of thought and expression of Chinese citizens. The Chinese model is being exported, and even democracies may not be immune. With me to discuss this hugely decisive development are two outstanding journalists who have been exposing the Great Firewall and probing it for holes on the ground in China and contributed with truly exceptional coverage in international media. Mega Rajagopalan is a world correspondent for BuzzFeed News and based in the Middle East. Before that, she spent 6 years in Beijing working for BuzzFeed and Reuters, where she covered the intersection between technology and human rights. In fact, she covered it so diligently that the Chinese authorities denied renewing her visa after she helped expose the extent of the police surveillance state in Xinjiang province. But fortunately, there's still critical journalists on the ground in China, including Yuan Yang, who is Financial Times Beijing correspondent and also focuses on technology, including the sometimes uncomfortable relationship between Western private companies and the Chinese government. If at any given point you're confused about whether it's Mega or Yuan speaking, think Mega when you hear an American accent and Yuan when you hear a British one.
Unfortunately, the sound is not up to its usual standard due to a lack of a proper studio. But I promise that the content is well worth the occasional background noise.
So far in this podcast, I've covered low-tech censorship, such as the indexes of prohibited books and pre-publication licensing schemes. But China has reverse engineered the technology that was supposed to supercharge a free, open, and connected world of borderless information with programs like the Golden Shield, the Great Firewall, and we also hear of the so-called social credit score system being built. But for outsiders unfamiliar with Chinese culture and politics, it's very difficult to get a understanding of what exactly is going on and whether the comparisons with 1984 are fact or exaggeration. So could you take us through the basic structure of Chinese online censorship and surveillance in terms of scope and purpose? Even I know it's a big question, but sort of the executive summary.
So perhaps the first thing to do would be to make the distinction between surveillance and censorship, because the two things are also interlinked. China's probably best known for the Great Firewall, which is the name we give for the internet controls that prevent people within China from reading certain kinds of information about politics, about history, about news on the internet, both blocking foreign websites and also blocking Chinese domestic content within China. So in order to do that, the government has to first surveil people. It has to first know what people want to look at and what they're trying to read. And then on top of that, it has to censor. It has to not only be able to know what people are reading, but also to be able to block that. So in this way, we can think of censorship being surveillance plus blocking, or surveillance plus management. And I think it's important to make that distinction, because actually this is on a very high scale, a simple reflection of what is done by companies or other governments across the world who also need to monitor employees or monitor citizens' behavior in order to block certain kinds of content, certainly not on the same scale as China. There is a strong thread linking corporate surveillance and censorship to foreign governments and then to the Chinese development of its own Great Firewall.
I would just add that the Great Firewall is more or less an automated and rapidly kind of shifting way to block websites and apps wholesale. But in addition to that, Chinese government censorship regulations require private companies, especially social media platforms that are operating in the country, to sort of proactively censor content. And they require this of traditional media as well. So this is much more of an old school style of censorship in a lot of ways. You know, it often involves kind of legions of very young and underpaid workers that sort of sift through content that people post online and delete things that might be provocative. A lot of times these human censors, when you talk to them, they don't necessarily know what's okay and what's not okay on any particular day. So it's a system that sort of is ambiguous by design and is designed to encourage organizations and people to self-censor in order to continue doing business in the country.
But you said that it's ambiguous, so you don't exactly know where the red lines are, and that's by design. But are there sort of general decrees of, you know, you should avoid this or you should avoid that, or is it completely haphazard?
I think it's both. Based on interviews I've done, you know, with people who work in mainland Chinese media, as well as people who work in kind of content management at web companies, it seems like they do get sort of edicts from time to time saying, you know, this topic should not be discussed today. You know, if there's a protest in Hong Kong, for instance, they might get a notice saying, like, don't write about this, or if you're going to write about it, it should only be in sort of a certain way if you're a media organization. And, of course, there are a certain list of topics that are just never really written about at all in Chinese media, including the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre, any notion of independence for Taiwan, for instance, any notion of sovereignty for Tibet and Xinjiang. These topics are all, it's well known that they're off limits.
Mm-hmm. And I would say the clearest red line is any kind of mockery or satire that goes near the Chinese leadership.
Yeah.
Like Winnie the Pooh.
Exactly. Comparing Winnie the Pooh to Xi Jinping. A couple of years ago, a Chinese man was sentenced to 2 years in jail for calling President Xi Jinping a steamed bun.
Okay. That's pretty draconian. Can we try to break down some of the technologies used? So if you talk to Facebook, for instance, they... Now, 52% of the hate speech that they delete is flagged by AI, and I think it's almost 99% when it comes to nudity and terrorist speech. So AI is obviously a huge and important tool. Is the Chinese government also using AI? You said they had an army of censors, but that obviously is not as efficient as if you have AI or machine learning that's able to identify and sort of search and destroy content.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. You know, it takes, like, when you think about the volume of content that is being produced in mainland China, it's very, very difficult for censors to be able to pick through all of it. And when you think about how this system works, the resources are expended at the company level, right? So the way it works is that the government will say that, you know, you have a regulation that you must moderate content in this particular way. And the Chinese internet the Chinese social media platform will have to expend their own resources and hire people to sort of comply with that. So, I mean, Facebook, which obviously still censors content, but censors it at sort of far less than a Chinese social media platform would do, is still coming up upon this problem of scale. And that's why they've sort of poured all these resources into developing AI capabilities for content moderation. Now, it's really problematic when Facebook does it, because there is no independent auditing of these algorithms. There's really no oversight into what they choose to delete, what they consider to be hate speech or violation of their terms of service. It's just something that they sort of decide to do. And in China, that's like, it's almost even less transparent than that. So if you think about, you know, the fact that they're going to be building algorithms, or they're in the process of building algorithms to be able to censor content in a more efficient way at a higher rate, censor greater volume of content. I mean, I think the path only really leads to a further chilling of the discourse and more censorship.
You and you have perspectives on that as well? Or?
I think when it comes to the use of AI and censorship, the question, I think, is what is the Chinese government trying to maximize? Because if you're going to train a neural network, you have to have some kind of objective target for it. And as Mega suggested earlier, there's a lot of ambiguity in censorship regimes. So it's not clear that, you know, a certain form of mockery or a joke or a picture of Winnie the Pooh, you know, that you can't scale that on an objective level as being kind of 90% offensive to the Communist Party or whatever, because this is an entirely subjective emotion of political control and what the party sees as the boundaries of political control. So I'd say the way of thinking about the use of AI in censorship in China is not necessarily that it's going to be able to automatically detect what could be, say, fake news or what could be, you know, a financial scam, because I think there are many more objective ways in which Facebook can tell, for example, what is a scam and measure that against a reality than the Communist Party can tell what is, in quotes, politically offensive, which is not a very objective concept. But instead, you can think of AI as aiding what the human senses are already doing. So, for example, to use a concrete example, WeChat, the social messaging app, people use that to mostly to send text messages to each other. But if the text terms you're using contain a sensitive word that's part of the banned word list, like Tiananmen Square, for example, then that text would be filtered at Tencent's servers by the automated filters and blocked. So the way that some activists get around this is by using images of text rather than text itself. And then the way that the censors, again, try and get around that is to use AI to recognize what kinds of text there are in images, even if it's been distorted or slightly played around with, and then translate that back into text. So AI, I think, in censorship is a way of aiding human censors and being faster than the human activists.
As I understand it, not all undesirable content is outright delete or banned. Harvard scholar Gary King did these studies showing that the government also drowns out messages by flooding, sort of producing, I think it was like 500 million comments, flooding critical comments with pro-government propaganda. Is that also something that you have encountered, this tactic is being used?
I just wanted to add to the AI thing. Yeah, I mean, I was just going to say, you know, when I first started working in China, when I was a student there, was sort of around the same time as the Arab Spring movement. And I think the framework to think about the Chinese internet at that time was sort of a cat and mouse game. So you would have these kind of lumbering government censors trying to control information, and then you would have really clever Chinese internet users coming up with all of these methods to get their message out anyway. So Yuan mentioned people would use images so that you couldn't find text based on a keyword search. You know, people would swap characters that sort of sounded the same to create puns to get their message across. I'm trying to think of a good example, but they would make jokes and play with the language and use all sorts of like clever mechanisms to be able to evade censors. And a lot of times these posts would still get taken down, but they would stay up for a certain period of time, and they could really have the possibility of having an impact. But when you think about content filtering moving towards like a more heavily automated model, you know, it's sort of up in the air how good these models actually are, but I think certainly it increases the speed of moderation, and I think that's really poses a problem for this kind of particular style of discourse. And it's sort of it's hard to see how like activists like on a human level or like Chinese internet users in general would be able to get around that in the same way.
Yuan, do you have anything to add?
There's a phenomenon that one academic has termed indoctrinatement, so indoctrination in the form of entertainment, which I think has been surprisingly effective in China on social media over the last, I would say, 2 years. There's been a huge push from the government to get local government bodies to open up their own social media accounts on Weibo, which is China's microblogging website, or on WeChat, and to produce short video formats, to produce kind of really engaging things that can speak to a younger generation. Because I think there was a recognition that the propaganda machine within the Communist Party, which was set up, you know, in the 50s and 60s, and is probably resonant with my grandparents, doesn't really work for, you know, my generation or even younger people. And in order to counter that, the Communist Party went to find independent movie studios, designers, artists who could appeal and to younger people and use the memes and talk the language of the online generation of the kids born after the 2000s. And that has been the new push of propaganda in China. And we're increasingly seeing that happen. I mean, not just within the Chinese internet, but also on foreign platforms like Twitter and Facebook, which are banned within China. But the party is also trying to eke out a strong presence on. So all the state media channels in China, like the People's Daily and Xinhua, the state news agency, have very active Twitter accounts, and they use that to try to signal and broadcast both to the Chinese diaspora abroad, but also to, you know, foreigners who don't know very much about China, and try to show them the government view of China.
Meg, you spend a lot of time covering the even more extreme methods employed against the Muslim Uyghurs in Xinjiang province, where last year you gave a great speech here called something like the police surveillance state in Xinjiang province. Why and how are these extreme methods being used?
So to give a sense of what's actually happening, so Xinjiang is this huge region in China, which is in the west of China. It's right on the border of Central Asia. The population there is about 22 million. About 11 million of those are Turkic Muslims, including Uyghurs, as you pointed out. And this is a part of China that has sort of been beset by periodic bouts of unrest. There have been race riots. There have been knife and bomb attacks that the government has largely blamed on Uyghur separatist groups. And kind of in the name of tackling this security threat, the government is now waging this really heavy-handed campaign of extremely intensive electronic and physical surveillance, as well as mass incarceration, targeting Turkic Muslims in the region. Now, this is essentially a form of collective punishment for the actions of a small handful of people, all of whom, by the government's own statements, have already been punished through the criminal justice system. So I've written a lot about the kind of surveillance aspect of this, and I think Xinjiang is very unique to me because it shows that mass surveillance is, you know, I think everybody can feel that privacy is a sort of fundamental right that we're all entitled to, but it shows that surveillance has really, like, deadly consequences even beyond that, because it's the surveillance system that sort of fuels the government's ability to track people and to arbitrarily incarcerate them in massive internment camps and in prisons. So I guess when we talk about censorship and surveillance, both of these things are present in Xinjiang. The internet is, like, pretty unusable there. I remember the last time I was traveling there, a taxi driver was complaining to me that their rideshare app didn't even work because the internet was so slow. So it's, like, unusable to that point. It's like Uyghur language is sort of heavily censored in that region. I know an activist who was basically jailed for setting up a bunch of Uyghur language kindergartens because it's considered subversive to teach children in their own language. And I think on top of that, you have this surveillance system that uses all kinds of new technology, things like face recognition, car recognition.
Would that be just in the general, like if you walk down the street, there's facial recognition? everywhere, or?
Yes. So the way face recognition works is that you don't necessarily need a special camera to be able to do it. You just need a camera that's placed in a place with good light and that has a high resolution. So you wouldn't necessarily know, but certainly there's cameras everywhere, and they have the software platforms that enable them to do the face recognition. And on top of that, you have all these issues around consent, things like mandatory DNA testing, you know, people being asked to give up a lock of hair or an eyelash to be entered into a DNA database. You have things like iris scans, people whose walk has to be recorded for gait recognition. Nobody has consented to any of this stuff. And I think talking about censorship, it certainly had the effect of chilling discourse to a way I wouldn't have really imagined possible.
So even though in theory the Chinese government has said that there should not be any obstacles for foreign correspondents to report anywhere they like in the country, in practice we see a completely different picture. Every year, the Foreign Correspondents Club of China does a survey of the foreign correspondents in our community, which is a couple of hundred foreign correspondents. And last year, we found that in 2018, of the 26 foreign correspondents who said they traveled to the Xinjiang region, nearly all of them were harassed while they were there. Nearly all of them were followed visibly by police or by plainclothes police around all of their reporting, which meant that not only were they subject to physical intimidation themselves, but also their sources were subject to the threat of being then harassed by the police, which puts you as a foreign journalist in the very difficult position of either not talking to anybody at all and therefore not having any local voices, or knowing that if you were to talk to a local person, especially if they were a Uyghur Muslim person in Xinjiang, that they could then be subject to harassment by the police and could be disappeared. I mean, if you look at the statistics from the survey, it's really quite shocking. Like, of those 26 correspondents, 19 were asked to delete data that they had collected in Xinjiang, such as photos. A majority had their interviews with locals monitored, and several of them were also detained or had a colleague detained while they were in Xinjiang.
Yuan, you're still on the ground in China. You have not been denied visa like Mecca. So are you able to travel to Xinjiang and report on these issues? What's the attitude towards foreign journalists working in the country and covering this?
So in 2008, in the run-up to the Beijing Olympics, the Chinese government announced that the Chinese government announced that all foreign journalists in China could travel anywhere they liked within the country and do interviews, so long as they had a consenting interviewee, meaning there should be no geographical restrictions on travel. And in the 10 years since then, we've seen that principle be eroded greatly by controls, both in Xinjiang, where it's very difficult, and Mega can describe from her own experience, to enter and also to stay in Xinjiang as a journalist without being thrown out almost immediately. We had a survey, the Foreign Correspondents Club of China does an annual survey of working conditions, and found of the journalists who had traveled to Xinjiang in that year, which is maybe between one and two dozen journalists that year, all of them had been harassed. Some of them had been followed for thousands of kilometers by police. Some of them had been followed to their hotel rooms, had their hotel rooms searched, were told to basically turn around at the airport and go back home to Beijing. So that happens in Xinjiang at such a scale that it's very difficult to report there. But even more than just the harassment to the foreign journalist, I would say, is the harassment of your sources. If you speak to somebody on a street in Xinjiang, it's very likely that they will then be hassled by the police or disappeared, and then you have no idea what's happened to them. You cannot protect your sources. And so I think that makes it even more difficult and it puts foreign journalists in the dilemma of saying, if we're going to go to this region that is vitally important, we report on the atrocities happening here, how do we do that without endangering more people?
And of course, the rate of incarceration or internment is staggering. What the numbers coming out of there is perhaps a million. Is that a reliable figure?
Yeah, I think independent researchers, as well as international bodies like the UN human rights authorities, have pegged it at just above or sort of around a million people, and that also that's just people that are going to these internment camps that the government has termed termed education centers or places of professional training. And there's a whole nother part of the population, also sort of just around a million people, that are in the prison system. So taken all together, it's a remarkable number of people that are being incarcerated. And I should also note that a lot of this is because of people's religious and cultural practices. You know, I mean, this is this is a podcast about free speech, like this is a place where the practice of Islam has essentially been outlawed. You know, I've talked to people who have thrown away and burned religious books and like cultural books, who have thrown out prayer mats because their homes are being checked by local law enforcement authorities, and they don't want to be seen to have those things because it could get them detained. So it's really been a chilling environment.
This is, of course, bad enough internally in China, but as I understand it, Chinese surveillance and censorship technology is also starting to be exported to other countries. What are some of the examples of this? Yuan, would you start?
I guess there are two ways in which we can think about it. One is specific collaborations that the Chinese government has with other governments, or that Chinese surveillance companies have with other governments. So, for example, it's well documented that China has helped build some of Russia's own internet controls. So using the model of the Great Firewall in Russia, and that's a direct example of exporting practices. I think the second way we can think about this is also the export of the ideology behind internet controls. So over the last 5 years, Xi Jinping has argued very vocally on the world stage for a concept of cyber sovereignty, which in the Chinese sense basically means the ability to police your internet borders in the same way that you would police your physical borders. You decide who you get to let in, you decide who you get to throw out. And that approach to the flow of information is a fundamentally authoritarian approach that restricts speech and punishes people for speech within the country. So cyber sovereignty has now become this term that Xi's pushing very hard on a world stage, and arguing that this should be the new way of thinking about the internet. You know, implicit in that statement is that it's against the old way, or the American or Western way, of thinking about the internet as a place of free flow of information.
Megan, I think you mentioned that this has even had consequences in Latin America. Ecuador, is that right? That there's been a link there between China and Ecuador as well?
Yeah. So when I talked about Ecuador as part of the talk that I gave last year, but you know, there's been a lot of new information that's come out just even in the last year, and there's at least I think 24 countries that are now adopting Chinese surveillance systems, or Chinese-made surveillance systems, I should say, in various forms. So Ecuador is one example of a country whose police have built a facial recognition system. Or sorry, let me rephrase that. Ecuador is an example of a place where police have bought Chinese-made facial recognition technology, you know, to basically fight crime, as they would put it. But Ecuador is also a place that where human rights violations, you know, were taking place on a pretty broad scale under the last government. Ethiopia is another great example. Human Rights Watch has documented that Ethiopia bought a Chinese-made internet censorship system. You know, lots of countries, Zimbabwe, Saudi Arabia, even Germany, are buying Chinese-made surveillance equipment. So, I mean, none of this is to demonize China. China is not the only country that is producing these systems. And certainly lots of American firms, from Honeywell to IBM to Microsoft to Amazon, are selling surveillance products, and they're selling them to repressive regimes, and they are not monitoring how these systems are used, which is just as problematic. But in China, you have this kind of particular situation where the government is really encouraging, you know, its homegrown tech giants, and they've become successful in large part because of that encouragement. So encouragement can take different forms, you know, from government investment to things like awards programs that come with cash prizes, help with R&D, subsidies, you know, the government helping them broker deals with foreign governments that give them contracts. All of this stuff has really helped this kind of new breed of Chinese tech giant achieve international success. I literally just published a story about how this is taking place in the UAE. You know, the UAE, even in the context of the Gulf, has poured a lot of money into building its surveillance capabilities, and it's sort of best known for cell phone cracking. You know, breaking into the cell phones of dissidents, people like Ahmed Mansour, who is the most famous dissident in the UAE and who's now in prison. And now the UAE is going to be able to access all of this new kind of surveillance technology that takes us out of the world of our devices and into real life. Things like monitoring where you go, the behavior of crowds, what your face looks like, what your clothing looks like. And all of this technology is being made by not only by Chinese companies like SenseTime, Hikvision, Huawei, that have built and tested their technology in Xinjiang on Uyghur Muslims, but also a bunch of American companies that are selling the same kind of product.
Yeah, that was one of the things that struck me on in your talk. I think it was on Monday here at the Oslo Freedom Forum, where you mentioned the specific example of Cisco seeing China as a very lucrative market when it comes to contributing to digital or technological infrastructure that is needed to build these systems of censorship. So Western companies who enjoy and rely protections under the rule of law and so on actually contribute to undermining the same in China. Is that right?
So the history of Western companies in China has been a very ethically fraught one, I think we can all say. But I think it's interesting to consider from a historical perspective that the Chinese internet didn't come from nowhere. In the early 90s, the US was really leading the pack in developing the infrastructure for the internet. And so it was necessary, you know, for China to reach out to American companies like Cisco in order to start building their own internet anywhere. There would have not been, the Chinese internet as we know it today would not have been possible without American help and support and trade. And so now we have the situation where, I mean, unlike the 90s, where I think there was a lot more hope for China to become less oppressive, to open up eventually. There was, of course, the, you know, Bill Clinton's optimism that China could not control the internet and that it would be like nailing jello to a wall, and the internet would eventually democratize authoritarian regimes. And that's all proven to not be the case in China. I think in the last 5 years, especially after Xi Jinping's rule started, there's been a collective kind of rethinking and perhaps pessimism around China's direction of travel, and also that changes the cost benefit for foreign companies in China. It's not no longer as easy to say, okay, we'll operate in China and we'll just do this and we'll eventually wait for it to liberalize, because that does not look as much of an option today as it was perhaps in the early 2000s. So I think this puts companies like Google in a difficult position when it thinks about its engagement with China. They withdrew their search engine withdrew their search engine partly after hacking attempts from the Chinese side, but also after disagreements over censorship. And as we now know through the Intercept's reporting last year, there has been a deep discussion within Google as to reinstate that in the so-called Dragonfly project, a censored version of Google in China. I think whenever companies like Google censor themselves for the Chinese government, the question I would want to ask from a journalist perspective is, how can we know what's going on and how can we hold those companies accountable and hold them transparent? Because even companies like Facebook and Google, who say sell ads to Chinese companies and serve ads in China, have to censor those ads. There's always going to be, if you engage with the Chinese government, there are always going to be things that the government asks for you to do if you handle internet content that make you, as a company operating with liberal values, say, more uncomfortable. But what we don't have right now is any way of seeing how those companies make those decisions. So to give a really specific example, last month I wrote about how Google was censoring adverts for anti-surveillance software, not even for the software itself, but for guides that would help people get anti-surveillance software in China called VPNs that would help them bypass the Great Firewall. And it's not clear here whether it's actually against any specific Chinese law to serve these adverts, or whether the Chinese government had asked Google to do this as kind of a favor, or whether this was part of a negotiation that they had with the government to get something else in China. What was really disturbing about this whole situation was nobody could tell me, and certainly nobody from Google could tell me, why they had decided to censor. They couldn't point to a specific law and say, well, this is how our lawyers read the law. And they couldn't say, oh, this is an edict that we got from this ministry. And that's obviously because of Google's own need to protect its relationships with the Chinese government. But what that leaves us doing as media and as Google's stakeholders or even shareholders is simply we're left guessing as to what is the real negotiation going on and how much is a big company like Google willing to sacrifice in China.
So in the 1960s in Denmark, my home country, there was a newspaper that ran mocking cartoons of Chairman Mao, and the Chinese government was furious. It requested several meetings with our prime minister and minister of foreign affairs, and the Danish government said, more or less, well, you know, we have press freedom. You can complain all you want, but we're not going to change one thing. Fast forward to 2012 until 2016, and on several Chinese state visits, the police have been ordered to systematically remove pro-Tibetan and Falun Gong protesters, remove symbols, flags, and there was an independent commission that exposed this and showing systematic violations of the Danish constitution. And I found sort of similar incidents from other democracies, including Belgium, UK, France, and New Zealand. So if Western democracies are willing to compromise the rights of their own citizens to appease China, what are the odds of democracy standing up for the rights of citizens in China? Is there any hope of Western governments growing balls, if I may be so frank?
Can we use a different metaphor?
Okay, I can use a different metaphor. Growing a spine, yes, that's good.
So speaking as a British citizen, one big concern I have over Western democracy's engagement with China is the importance of trade ties with China and how much countries will be willing to put up in terms of political compromises in order to keep Chinese investment flowing. And Chinese investment into the UK is a significant amount of investment and growing and will likely be very important after Brexit eventually happens. So that's something that I worry about, you know, for my home country, for the UK. Would our politicians be willing to speak truth to power if that costs them dearly in terms of trade deals and in terms of investment? I don't know whether you see the same thing happening in Denmark. That explains the shift. But as China, as China's economy grows greater in influence and in size, you've seen China, I think, at least you've seen even Chinese commentators, you know, within the political think tank community in China talk about the Belt and Road Initiative, in which China does infrastructure deals with developing countries. You see Chinese commentators talk about that explicitly as a realpolitik move in which you buy political influence through literally buying infrastructure and therefore seeing economic ties as a political weapon. And I think that could very easily happen in developed countries as well as developing countries.
Mega, what's your perspective on this?
I guess as an American, I think that the U.S. is one of the few places left in the world now where the dominant narrative about China is not, this is a big global power that we want investment from, sort of despite the human rights violations, and rather is a narrative of, you know, this is a competitor, this is a strategic competitor, this is a competitor for sort of global influence, and a country that is sort of bad for the U.S. in terms of trade and the way it manages its own economy and all of these other forces outside of human rights. And the Trump administration has sort of adopted this narrative, and I think sort of in service of that narrative has also spoken a lot about human rights in the country, particularly about the Uyghur issue. They've been quite vocal, like officials at a very high level, including Vice President Mike Pence. Now, that being said, there has been sort of discussion of sanctions on China over the Uyghur issue, targeted sanctions like the Magnitsky Act, as well as penalties for companies that are found to be sort of complicit in the building of internment camps and things like that. But these measures have not actually been put into place yet. And my understanding is that there's still sort of a debate sort of being waged within the administration and, also in Congress about whether to put those measures in place. And I think that underpinning the debate is the realization that, you know, China is a big economic power. It is the U.S. and China are very interdependent and continue to be so despite all of the kind of issues with Huawei and other companies in the U.S. And I think that that's sort of what makes kind of taking on human rights in China like categorically different from doing the same thing in a place like Myanmar, for instance, or Eritrea, or any number of other, or even North Korea, any number of countries that are sort of have really, really repressive governments and have a deteriorating human rights situations, but are not sort of geopolitically significant. And I think that at least in my time writing about China, the kind of geopolitical rise of China has been kind of the dominant story. And I think, you know, that is certainly continuing, especially with the U.S. withdrawal from the world, I guess, the kind of trend towards nationalism and isolationism that we're seeing in the U.S., which I think means that China just becomes more and more important to the geopolitical structure, more important to Europe and other kind of third-party countries, and I think that means it just gets harder to take on human rights.
Very last question. Are there any developments that you see within China that may see the Great Firewall being torn down in the foreseeable future? Should we be optimistic or pessimistic?
You know, it's interesting. I often think about this an anecdote that was told to me by a Tibetan exile. So this guy is like he's a digital security trainer, and he works with lots of Tibetan exiles. He I believe he's based in either New York or Dharamsala or both. And there was a phenomenon a few years ago where Tibetan activists would get phishing emails all the time. They would be at some conference, and they would get an email purporting to be from a colleague, but it was actually malware, right? This is a very common thing faced by activists from all over the place. So I talked to this guy probably about a year ago, and I was just trying to get a read on what they were sort of up against lately. And he was like, you know, the phishing emails have pretty much stopped. And I was like, well, why? He was like, I don't think it's because of a lack of interest in the Tibetan issue from the Chinese government. And his theory about this was that if all of your communications are taking place on WeChat and you're already monitoring WeChat, why do you need to send someone malware? Like, you probably don't, right? And I thought this was...
WeChat is the malware,
right? You can think about it that way. So I thought this was interesting because I think... you know, a few years ago when we talked about the internet in China, we were mostly talking about censorship. And I think that that has really shifted to surveillance. And it sort of shows that censorship and surveillance are these two interrelated phenomena, but they're not always working together. In fact, they're sometimes in conflict. So if you censor everything, if you censor very, very heavily, then you're not getting a read on what people are actually thinking and actually doing. And especially if you're primarily doing this in digital spaces, you're losing your ability to monitor what people are talking about in real life. So I think one of the big changes we've seen in the Chinese government's approach to control is this kind of move to a surveillance system that is sort of complementary of the censorship system. So to your question, if I had to take a guess, I think if censorship does change significantly, or if it's reduced or shifts in a certain way to be more permissive, I think it will be sort of in service of or complementary to this other force of surveillance that is sort of more and more omnipresent and, like, by and large, still pretty invisible.
Are there any reasons to be optimistic?
So I'll give a bunch of, like, hopeful, happy thoughts to end with. So the first is that as the flow of Chinese students studying abroad for university increases, so does the flow of information back into China. If you look at the use of VPNs, of virtual private networks, software which helps you bypass the Great Firewall and also protect your communications from being monitored, it's not enough. A recent study found that it's not enough just to give Chinese students VPNs, because once they get that software, like, what would they read? They don't have developed reading habits. They might not read in English. They might not want to read the New York Times or the Financial Times or whatever. They might be very content in their own media space. But if you give students VPNs plus some training and some education in what platforms they might be able to access, and inculcate reading habits that are outside of the usual, then that behavior becomes sticky. And so for students who are studying abroad for the first time, often that's the first time they are accessing Facebook or any foreign platforms, the first time that they're reading about the history of their own country from a different perspective. And that flow is going to keep on increasing as the Chinese middle class sends its beloved only children outside of China. So I think that's one reason to be optimistic. And although there has been a crackdown on VPNs, there are still VPN providers surviving, people creating their own VPN their own private VPN servers or simply using foreign SIM cards in China to bypass the Great Firewall. So there are still several, you know, chinks in the armor for the Great Firewall. And the second reason to be optimistic is that although, as we discussed before, foreign companies have been complicit in censorship, in handing over private email information, in all sorts of abuses of privacy that have led to severe consequences in China, at the same time, there are still some platforms that are global platforms that have not been censored. I think Microsoft's GitHub is the best example of a really huge platform that has a large flexibility for the kinds of content it can host, and is very economically important to China because it's used as a code-sharing platform. So many big tech companies will use it in order for its programmers to collaborate on projects. That's also been used as a platform for uploading potentially, you know, politically subversive material for campaigning. There's been a recent anti-long working hours campaign called the anti-996 campaign that's use GitHub as a platform. And because it's been hosted by a foreign company outside of China, but also because the whole platform would be really economically painful and costly for China to block, so far GitHub has not been blocked, and I ideally hope that it would not be blocked. So the final point of hope is that although we have the stereotype of Chinese people not caring very much about internet privacy, actually privacy is a rising concern in China. And it's been a concern that the government has actually been really promoting counterintuitively for the last year and a half. The government has cracked down on the biggest tech giants in China, Ant Financial, Baidu, for violating user privacy, partly because the government is also pushing a new set of data protection standards following the steps of GDPR that don't ensure, you know, personal rights against the government's intrusions, of course, but do try to look at consumer rights against big companies. And the government is keen to make sure that big companies do deal with data sensitively. So as the government does that, as there's more discussion of privacy, I think there's going to be more attention, more awareness brought to the ways in which Chinese individuals can give themselves the tools to prevent all kinds of surveillance, including corporate surveillance, but also government surveillance. And I'm thinking right now of, you know, a couple of entrepreneurs, young entrepreneurs in China who are developing end-to-end encryption solutions that you can wrap on top of existing platforms like Facebook or like WeChat. And that all comes from the basic seed of awareness raising around the importance of privacy. And I think that seed is growing very quickly in China now.
Thank you so much. This was excellent. Thanks.
Thank you.